Please be seated. Good afternoon. This is the first case on the Southern Panel's argument calendar today is Coyote Springs Investment, LLC versus Real Party in Interest, Bright Source Energy, Inc. by RIT, case number 64623. Mr. Bice, you're ready to go.
I am. If I might, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for our rebuttal. May it please the court. I'm Todd Bice on behalf of Coyote Springs Investment. The question presented for the court concerning this writ proceeding, I think, is a fairly fundamental one to how matters will be controlled before the district courts. The district court's decision effectively stands for the proposition that once a witness is sworn, whether at trial or at deposition, that witness may have no further communication with counsel concerning the case. There are a number of problems we would submit with such a ruling beyond its pure impracticality. I would make the following point to begin with. It is the rare case, the very rare case, especially in today's world, where especially high-ranking executives' depositions are completed in a one-day session. I know that this court has adopted a rule on that relatively recently, but it's still not the norm, nor is it the practice. And it is very unlikely that those depositions continue from day to day until completed. They are quite frequently interrupted, and quite frequently counsel and the witness have to confer, including about privileged matters. The district court's ruling, however, is that once the witness is sworn at the deposition, or even at trial, the witness is now not permitted to communicate with counsel any further. That poses, I think, a number of obstacles to the right to counsel, not only in criminal cases, but in civil cases. But one could imagine circumstances in criminal cases where a witness is on the stand in the rare instance, which I will acknowledge is rare, where the criminal defendant actually takes the stand, they are no longer entitled to confer with counsel during breaks or anything of the like. I think such a rule, that hard rule that the district court has adopted here, is not in keeping with Nevada law and should not be sustained by this court. What happened in this case is fairly straightforward. The deposition of Harvey Whittemore occurred. Mr. Whittemore was, at the time of his deposition, no longer affiliated with Coyote Springs Investment. However, at the time of the underlying transaction, Mr. Whittemore was the de facto, he was the decision maker. He was the owner, manager of the enterprise. He was less responsible for the decision making. At issue was a lease that he was principally involved in negotiating and ultimately responsible for in conjunction with legal counsel. At his first day of deposition, he testified quite extensively as to the purpose of the lease and as to the purpose of a termination provision in that lease. He was questioned extensively by both sides. During the second day of his deposition, counsel for BrightSource attempted to insinuate, as they have throughout the case, that somehow the lease is wrong, that the lease doesn't reflect the true agreement of the parties, notwithstanding the fact that it's signed by BrightSource. And the basis for that contention are two things. One, a prior draft of the lease, and then subsequently a term sheet that was prepared that is after the lease was signed and executed that doesn't even pertain to BrightSource, to somehow suggest that the lease was mistaken. So throughout the second day of Mr. Whittemore's testimony, he is asked repeated questions about somehow isn't the lease wrong? Couldn't the lease be wrong? Doesn't this document really say that the lease is wrong? The witness asked to be shown the lease itself so that he could compare the two. He was deprived of that by the examining counsel and was pestered over and over again about whether or not this document is consistent with the lease without being given an opportunity to compare them. After BrightSource was done with this examination, in total, there was a break. Mr. Whittemore, again, although no longer affiliated with Coyote Springs, still has the attorney-client communications that pertain to the lease negotiations, and so therefore had a conference with counsel for Coyote Springs Investment, both litigation counsel and the company's in-house counsel, who wanted to clarify and make sure that there were no privilege issues that were going to come up because obviously they were going to challenge the claims that had been made by BrightSource concerning the documents that he had been shown. That happened, and again, what Mr. Whittemore did is he testified under that examination absolutely consistently with what he had testified for the full day before, which was that the lease is the correct document. The lease is what the parties signed, and the lease is what the parties had negotiated. notwithstanding a pre-existing draft that was unsigned and had been changed, and notwithstanding a subsequent term sheet that did not have anything to do with BrightSource. As a result, the accusation has now been made that, well, somehow Mr. Whittemore's consistent testimony was somehow coached. Their argument is, from BrightSource, is, well, we think it's inconsistent. We think that we basically got him to admit something that was contrary to the written document that the parties had all signed. Well, if that's their argument, that's their entitlement, is to present their argument to the finder of fact. That happens in
Mr. Bice, we've read the transcripts here. I think the focal point of the writ is whether or not this court should undertake a rule in this area, and if so, what that rule should be. Perhaps you and your colleague could focus on the legal question and what this appeal or what an appellate court should look at.
Yes. Justice Horsley, I will. And I actually, the way you phrase it, I think, is a good way to phrase it, because I really think that's what you're being asked to do, is to adopt a rule, and a rule that would govern how depositions are conducted. I would submit that would be an appropriate process for rulemaking, to get all input from the bar about this process, because I fundamentally, notwithstanding my healthy respect for the district court, I fundamentally disagree with her position that it is an accepted practice in this jurisdiction that once the witness is sworn, counsel can have no communication with the witness.
There is considerable authority in the federal rule decisions and a few state courts, though, that have focused on approaches taken in Hall and in Stratosphere, and you have argued those. Why shouldn't this panel look at those for purposes of resolving this case?
I think this court does have to look at those for purposes of resolving this case, because the issue was presented by the district court. But what I was submitting is, in the broader context, if it was going to be a rule, I would think that that would be appropriate for the court's rulemaking process to get input. But turning to the specific facts of this case, or the application to this case, as we have pointed out, we think that the Hall decision, which is really what BrightSource relies upon, which the district court seemed to basically rely upon in total, has been, I think, pretty heavily criticized by lower courts or by other courts, including in the In Re Stratosphere decision, which points out that it is largely, while the policy objectives might have some virtue, it's unworkable and it's too harsh, and it deprives both litigants and witnesses of their right to confer with counsel. The purpose of the rule is to get the testimony of the witness, not to get the testimony of the lawyer. We all understand that. But that process can be handled under the construct that In Re Stratosphere sets forth. There was no question pending when counsel conferred with Mr. Whittemore. The question had ended by BrightSource. The witness was passed, as we would say if it was in a courtroom. The witness had been passed. There was a conference, a very short conference, and the witness was entitled to be advised about questions of privilege and the like that he would
As present. A starting point, if counsel is going to confer with a witness, particularly someone who's not currently in the employ of a company, is there an obligation for counsel to disclose the intent to engage in the conference with the witness, and to the extent that that conversation is going to involve attorney-client privilege, is it necessary to assert that before the conference?
I would think not, because I couldn't recognize what would be the purpose of, I guess, of making the announcement in advance. The conference, this is a former, the highest-ranking executive at the company that clearly had intimate knowledge about the negotiations and the role of counsel in those negotiations concerning the lease term. That being the case, I don't see what policy objective under the law is served by saying that counsel has to announce it in advance, that that's the purpose of the conference.
Do they have to disclose it?
What's that?
Do they have to disclose they've engaged in the conference?
There is certainly no objection. I mean, people will typically ask the witness whether or not they have met with counsel, both before the deposition or during any breaks. That's a fairly routine deposition question. But I know of no circumstance, in my experience or with any of the other district court judges, who have taken the position that those conferences are not otherwise privileged or that privilege is waived by holding them. And that's what this district court did in this circumstance.
But what if the conference involves something other than privileged communication?
Well, as long as it does not constitute basic witness coaching, telling the witness how to answer questions, there shouldn't be any impediment, I think, to counsel's communication with the witness. And that's what we feel very strongly, that we followed the exact contours of the Insure Stratosphere decision. And Mr. Whittemore testified that he had not been coached. He was asked specific questions about roles that he played and the roles of in-house counsel at the time he played that were privileged communications. And he was highlighted, and those facts were highlighted, and they were stated on the record by him at the time of trial. I think that's completely appropriate and should be something that this court allows parties and their lawyers to protect, because if we don't, parties and witnesses and counsel will not be able to communicate, and it deprives them of their effective counsel.
Yes, Mr. Bice, in this particular case, it seems to be there's a break. During that break, counsel for Bright Source indicates from the record, I'm going to put this on the record, my objection to any discussion during the break based upon questions that I've asked of this witness.
Yes.
And there's no recital back as to what might occur on the break in terms of saying, well, we have a right to talk to our witness, or we're only going to do this or that. Nothing is stated. There's some kind of communication. I understand Mr. Whittemore made his representations. But even if we don't, say, look to adopt Hall, if we look to adopt Stratosphere, there's a position about putting things back on the record. And if you don't do that, it creates a problem. What's your position, and where do you think the court should be?
Well, I think in this particular case, Justice Douglas, on a going-forward basis, if the court outlines what the clear parameters are going to be, then all the parties will know those, and if the court's going to require an advance notice on the record to address it, obviously, then all counsel will follow that. But there is no controlling authority in this jurisdiction on it. We were guided by, at the time, in Ray Stratosphere, and I believe that we followed it quite closely in terms of what we did. I understand that there's an objection. Parties can make objections all the time about they don't want witnesses to be able to confer with counsel, but they don't have the right to just decree it by the simple fact that they announce it on the record.
But we are here because of the fact that objection was raised,
yes.
Communication was had, the judge exercising the discretion, that's the matter that's before us right now.
Correct.
Exercised their discretion, so the question is, which way does it push?
Well, she exercised, but I agree with you, Justice Douglas, but she exercised her discretion by saying that basically I'm adopting, and she believes that Nevada follows this hard and fast rule that once the witness is sworn, the witness can have no communication. And I think that is the problem, because if you look at In Re Stratosphere, which is what we think the majority rule is and the only one that's really practical, the counsel and the witness are permitted to communicate. The fact that an opposing party objects to it cannot be the criteria, because they would always object and just say, well, now I'm going to deprive you of the ability to communicate with the witness.
So that word communicate is a little broader, I think, than what's outlined in Stratosphere as to mistake and other things, mm-hmm. in accordance, as well as the ultimate privilege situation. And gets back to the real issue on the table, and that is whether or not there's been coaching or direction from counsel, opposed to just saying we're going to assert privilege or we're...
I understand that, and as I would submit in all cases, you basically have to take the witness's testimony, and if the court doesn't consider the testimony to be credible when they say that they were not coached and that this is consistent with their prior testimony, that's what finders of fact always do. You make that argument in front of the jury, or you make that argument in front of the judge that their testimony has somehow changed or that their testimony has somehow been influenced. And that's how you get to the ultimate end. But I would submit that it's not an appropriate outcome to say any time that there's a communication, especially on this record, that somehow all privileges are then disappear.
What do we do on, I'm thinking about my special master days of MGM, where Carl Duncan, the expert, the fire expert for the plaintiffs, was deposed for 22 days. And I'm sure that during those 22 days, they talked about the case. I mean, you can talk so much about baseball and sex, and they're coming to win, but you've got to talk about the case. And I'm just wondering if we make a rule, we want to make a rule that's workable.
That's just...
And we want to make a decision that's workable both to both sides here, so it's fair.
That's our point, I would submit, is there are many witnesses. I'm in trial right now that will resume tomorrow with Judge Denton. The chief executive, in that case, my client, his deposition spanned over a three-day period, spread out over a period of, I believe, 4 months by the time we were able to actually get the last installment in his deposition done. That's not uncommon at all. No lawyer can represent a client and not be able to communicate with them or communicate with the chief operating officer at the time who was in control of the client concerning the very matters that go to the heart of the case. And I see that I'm out of time, so I will reserve if I have any left. I thank the board.
Mr. Breyer.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Peter Bernhardt on behalf of BrightSource Energy, where they responded in this case. As the Court is aware, we didn't have the teachings of this Court in front of us at the time these issues were presented to the District Court in December of 2013. Since December of 2013, this Court has issued two opinions, Las Vegas Sands, I'll call it Las Vegas Sands 1, regarding Jacobs, and then second was the case involving KB Homes, Nevada Advance Opinion 13 and 37. Both of those cases dealt with, of course, NRS 50, Chapter 50.125 on document review, but the ruling that the Coyote Springs people asked this court to establish here would simply undermine what the court has taught in those two cases. If this evidence is excluded, it's a roadmap how to get around Las Vegas Sands 1. Just have trial counsel review Justin Jones's timesheets and notes, read them to him. Then it becomes a communication, not a document. Justin Jones has not seen the document. Therefore, the same type of refreshing recollection or the appearance of coaching. Whether coaching occurs or not is not really the concern of the court as a policy matter. It's whether or not the appearance of impropriety occurs by allowing oral communications that would be prohibited if it was a review of a document.
What about oral communications pre-deposition, where you sit down with the client? The nice thing about this argument is both of you have done complex litigation to know how important it is to be able to talk to your witnesses.
No question about it.
Deposition and before trial.
No question about it, Your Honor. And I think the dividing line for a fair and workable rule that will address Mr. Weiss's practical concerns, respecting the rights of my client to be able to examine credibility and the rights of Mr. Bice's client to look at and communicate with a client, stops when the oath is given. Deposition trial, I think the recent case, the Las Vegas Development Associates case, says there should not be a distinction between deposition testimony, trial testimony. The same rule should apply. Once the oath is given, then preparation stops. And then the witness is on his or her own and has to give answers to questions. Now, there is a rule, I think, that would come across very clearly, and the court cited it, at footnote 5 of the Las Vegas Sands 1 decision, quoting from Julian versus Raytheon. The court said, plaintiff's counsel, in that case, made a decision to educate their witnesses by supplying documents that they thought were privileged. The Raytheon defendants are entitled to know the content of that education. I think that's what happened here. During a break in the deposition, and it was a short break, we're not talking about multi-day depositions of witnesses in major securities litigation, the rule can be set up so that during these breaks in a deposition or trial, then there cannot be substantive communication about the testimony or evidence in the case. For example, all of you have experience as trial judges. You would not allow an attorney for a party who was on the witness stand during a break, 5-minute restroom break, to go out in the hall with the attorney and communicate about the substance of the testimony. We all have been taught that is not proper. The witness is on his or her own at that point. And I think it's important to recognize the rule that we are looking at today is whether or not Judge Gonzalez exercised her discretion properly under the facts and circumstances as presented. And that's a workable rule. The district court should make decisions based on discretion on those facts. And here, all factors in this case weighed toward exercising her discretion to require Mr. Whittemore to disclose what was said during a five-minute break in the deposition. This is the key issue in the case, the most important issue. There was a change in testimony. Mr. Bice says he was consistent. We say it's inconsistent, but there was definitely a change. Questions asked before the break and after the break. All we know at this point is we asked questions before the break. We got certain answers. Break occurred.
Having to do with the comparison of the term sheet and the ultimate lease.
The term sheet itself, and that's the important point here, every piece of paper in this case before and after the lease was signed says the same thing on what the business deal was.
What I couldn't determine is, was the term sheet part of the first day's deposition?
I think the first day of the deposition covered a lot of territory, including the term sheets, including
was
the lease.
Was the term sheet discussed in the first day of deposition?
Yes, my recollection is that it is. The record will show for sure.
Reread it, okay.
In any event, we, as examining credibility of Mr. Whittemore, are entitled to look at what the basis of his testimony was. And if it was the contents of this in-deposition conference with counsel and with in-house counsel, we're entitled to know that, because that's what Judge Gonzalez needs to weigh credibility. He's the key witness in the case. None of the other witnesses testified that the business deal was changed to what the lease said. They testified they didn't know, they didn't recall. Everybody was operating before and after the lease was signed as if the business deal was what the term sheet and the summary said. Our defense, which we raised as an affirmative defense, was mutual mistake. We believe that both sides overlooked the fact that the lease, 40 pages, did not reflect the business deal. And that's what this whole case hinges on. Key issue, key witness, change in testimony. The time for witness preparation ceases and the witness has to give his or her testimony, not the testimony as refreshed by counsel or as discussed by counsel in the course of a deposition conference under which the conferencing party hides behind the attorney-client privilege. Parties may choose, as the Julian case said, cited by this court in Sands 1, the party may choose to discuss substantive testimony during a break. Nothing to prohibit that. I don't think it's a good practice, but this court does not have to bar all discussions. The consequence is that once those substantive discussions about the testimony of the witness occur, then it is open for cross-examination. And you cannot shield the contents of those in-trial conversations during a break with counsel or in-deposition conference. And we already have a lot of rules that will fit where there's some not controversial. And this one, again, has never been decided, as Mr. Bice indicates. This court has already indicated through the rules, speaking objections are prohibited during a deposition. Interrupting a deposition or trial while a question is pending. Clearly, that's prohibited. Interrupting a deposition or even trial testimony to determine whether a privilege exists is protected, and that's okay. A party should be allowed to confer about whether a privilege exists. Interrupting the deposition or trial testimony to discuss substantive testimony is what I'm saying is and should be prohibited, or at a minimum, subject to disclosure.
Well, on that point, Mr. Gerard, in the Stratosphere case at page 621, the court comments about permitting private meetings during recesses and depositions and says that its purpose is to ensure that the, quote, client did not misunderstand or misinterpret questions or documents, that the attorney fulfills, quote, their ethical duty to prepare a witness, close quote, or determine whether to assert a privilege. It seems under the Stratosphere case that at least that decision permits counsel to confer during a deposition for one of the purposes, to be sure that the client didn't misunderstand or misinterpret questions or documents having nothing to do with privilege. So, for example, in this case, under Stratosphere, would it have been inappropriate, in your view, for Mr. Bice or the deposing counsel to meet with Mr. Whittemore and inquire of him as to whether his recollection was faulty about the later explanation he gave concerning point A to point B concerning the term sheet in the lease?
That would not be improper, and the rule should be that that is disclosable. As you say, that's separate and apart from privilege. That's not a privileged communication. That's looking at a document to see if he's misinterpreted as the
judge. But you would agree that that's an appropriate conference during a break between counsel and client?
That's correct, and that's the rule of Stratosphere. And a couple of quick points. Stratosphere.
But you would get an opportunity to inquire of the witness.
Absolutely.
As to whether his memory was refreshed or improved upon, and that's not coaching.
Correct. I can ask those questions, though, and that's what Judge Gonzalez, in her discretion, said I was entitled to do. So Stratosphere was not a case where there was a pending dispute. Remember, that was a case where the parties asked for a deposition protocol in advance. Mm-hmm. There was not an actual controversy. And Judge Hunt refused to issue a rule. None of his deposition protocol rules discuss this point. He simply says, we understand attorneys will be professional. In my view, that means don't talk substance during breaks and depositions. That's all. And that's a good rule, and I think the points I've outlined present a workable rule, which, as I understand, has been that practice should be, maintains the integrity of the courts, avoiding the appearance of impropriety, even if there is no substantive impropriety.
If you adopt Stratosphere, is that what you're asking us to do?
No. What I'm saying is that Stratosphere did not rule on this point. Stratosphere was a guideline for how the parties would conduct depositions, and Judge Hunt refused to enter any part of his order on what could or could not happen during deposition breaks. On that issue, he said, I trust the parties will conduct themselves properly and the truth will win out or something to that effect. So that does not stand for the proposition that is being advanced here by Coyote Springs. Did not rule on the propriety of discussing substantive testimony during a break in depositions.
Mr. Bernhardt, if in this particular case, if looking from the standpoint as I'm hearing, if we have no rule in place, even though we can put a rule in place, should we do anything as to what happened, or should we reverse the discretion exercised by the judge in this matter?
I mean, the workable rule is the district court can look at the facts and circumstances and make that decision, which is what she did, based on the factors I outlined, importance of the witness, importance of the testimony, change in testimony, whether it's consistent or inconsistent, before and after a conference. And the court's expression was, I don't understand why counsel would talk to a witness about substance during a break. She was shocked that that happened. Because again, that's what I think all of us have been taught. You don't talk substantive testimony during a break just to avoid the appearance that there's been any coaching, that the recollection has been refreshed in a way that amounts to witness coaching. If I can refresh recollection of a witness by telling the witness what he should remember, or I can show the witness a document, say, did you misunderstand this document? That's okay. And that's a workable rule that I think is consistent with all the practice and the best practices of attorneys throughout the country. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bice, I'll give you 1 minute to wrap up.
Thank you, Justice Hartson. The witness's credibility can be examined. If you really contend that the witness changed their testimony, you have a transcript. The problem here for Bright's horse is that he didn't change his testimony. And repeated objections were noted on the record by Bright's horse's examination that they were not being forthright or being fair with the witness in terms of telling the witness that the term sheet and the lease were the same, and trying to get the witness to adopt that premise. That objection was noted repeatedly on the record. There was no confusion about why the break was being taken and that the witness was going to be conferred with. So I don't believe that there's some additional purpose served by specifically noting it, again, at that point in time, since it had been noted repeatedly during the examination of the witness. And again, I think the argument you're hearing from Bright Source is exactly why they're wrong. Their position is, once the witness is sworn, the witness is on its own. With all due respect, that isn't the law, and that's exactly what Stratosphere says. Preparation is the same.
Mr. Bass, before you sit down,
yes.
At the opportunity, what would you have this court write based upon what's presently in before it?
What I would have this court write is that, consistent with the Stratosphere, the In Re Stratosphere decision, that there is no bar of counsel and client, or counsel and witness, in this case the witness being a former high-ranking executive that was the whole, that basically had the privileged communications, that there is no bar in counsel and the witness conferring. If the insinuation is made that the witness has been coached or the witness has changed their testimony, the witness can be challenged on that, and if the witness has in fact changed their testimony, that goes to their credibility. And let me just, this ties back into the reason why documents are different. Because when you give a witness a document and you're asking them, does that refresh their recollection, the reason that the rule is you can then see the document, even if the document was privileged, because you're entitled to know whether or not that document in fact refreshed their recollection or not.
Well, but Mr. Brenner makes a very good point. You're not suggesting for a moment that it's appropriate for a lawyer during a break to confer with a witness and read the witness the emails rather than have the witness read the emails to refresh their recollection, are you?
No, I am not doing that. And that is not the rule, and that is not, there's been no suggestion that anything like that happened here. Again, Mr. Whittemore testified under oath.
Well, we don't know, because Mr. Bernard hasn't been able to ask Mr. Whittemore what happened in the conference and what was looked at and what was discussed.
You made a
record.
Yes.
You asserted privilege. That's the sole basis under which the conference was conducted, according to your testimony, or his testimony.
According to his testimony, though, Justice Hardison, he was specifically asked whether or not any refreshing of recollection, of his recollection, occurred, and he said no, that it did not. And that was specifically discussed. And I would also note on the record that there were no questions asked at the deposition by Bright Source after the witness was passed back on the subject.
I asked the question in Stratosphere, if you follow that.
Yes.
Stratosphere requires counsel to disclose at the deposition that I conferred with this witness, I assert the attorney-client privilege, mm-hmm. or I conferred with the witness and I asked the witness whether or not the documents were misunderstood or misinterpreted. There is a disclosure about the content of the conference or its protection for attorney-client privilege. There's actually three things that Stratosphere talks about.
There's three things that Stratosphere says are permissible during the break. I don't recall Stratosphere saying that you must announce all of those in advance before you can have the conference with the witness or those. And then, again, the witness here testified after the fact to what was discussed in terms of the subject matter at the break. So I don't think it accomplishes any sort of judicial purpose to say in advance you have to announce, especially in the context of this case, Justice Hardesty, where the repeated protests were made on the record about the misleading nature of the documents.
The pronouncement and description is not before. At page 621 through 622, the court is saying, quote, should be placed on the record the fact that a conference is held,
mm-hmm.
the subject of the conference, and the decision reached as to whether to assert a privilege.
But that's talking about whether or not the break is taken to assert.
No, it's after the conference. It says specifically, and at following the conference, counsel should, and so forth.
I understand, Justice Hardesty, but in this particular case, what is the determinative outcome of that? It wasn't stated on the record. Again, when Mr. Whittemore was questioned about it, he testified about exactly what happened with respect to the communication. Had that been given on the record at that moment in time, would have it changed the outcome? It shouldn't. And I guess
that's
my point.
Going to secure a stay from the trial court judge to inquire further into what transpired in the conference while this matter was being reviewed here at the Supreme Court. Is that right?
I'm sorry?
Did you secure a stay from inquiry by Mr. Bernard into what Mr. Whittemore and counsel conferred on after her ruling?
I believe that we examined the witness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe Mr. Bernard examined the witness any further after we examined the witness. And I don't believe we obtained a stay of the ruling, but I do not believe we obtained a stay of inquiry concerning a voir dire subject matter to either contest the criteria in re stratosphere or not. I don't believe that the record would support that. We obtained a stay of the underlying ruling.
Okay.
And if I'm wrong on that, my colleagues will correct me, but I don't.
All right. We'll look at the record.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Bias.
Thank you,
Mr. Barron.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments this afternoon, and this matter will stand submitted.